Okay, let's pick up what we left off in 1 Kings. We left off in chapter 3. Solomon's throne has now been firmly established. And he's now beginning his reign over Israel. And it says in verse 1 in chapter 3 of 1 Kings, it says, Then Solomon formed a marriage alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and took Pharaoh's daughter and brought her to the city of David until he had finished building his own house and the house of the Lord and the wall around Jerusalem. The people were still sacrificing on the high places because there was no house built for the name of the Lord until those days. Now Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father David, except he sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. And the king went to Gibeah to sacrifice there, for that was the great high place. And Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on the altar. In Gibeah, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream at night, and God said, Ask what you wish me to give you. Then Solomon said, Thou hast shown great loving kindness to thy servant David, my father, according as he walked before thee in truth and righteousness and uprightness of heart towards thee, and thou hast reserved for him this great loving kindness, that thou hast given him a son to sit on the throne as it is to this day. And now, O Lord my God, thou hast made thy servant king in place of my father David, and yet I am but a little child that do not know how to go in or come in. And thy servant is in the midst of thy people, which thou hast chosen, a great people who cannot be numbered or counted for multitudes. So give thy servant an understanding heart to judge thy people, to discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of thine? And it was pleasing to the sight of the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing. And God said to him, Because you have asked this thing, and have not asked for yourself long life, or have asked riches for yourself, or have you asked for the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself discernment to understand justice, behold, I have done according to your words. Behold, I have given you a wise and discerning heart, so that there has been no one like you before you, nor shall one like you arise after you. And I have also given you what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that there will not be any among the kings like you all of your days. And if you walk in my ways and keep my statutes and commandments as your father David did, then I will prolong your days. Then Solomon awoke, and behold, it was a dream. And he came to Jerusalem and stood before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, and offered burnt offerings, and made peace offerings, and made a feast for all of his servants. Now, before we go any further, I wanted to read this far down because I wanted to get a gist of the theme in this chapter 1. The first verse, it talks about when Solomon became king, he now made some alliances, political alliances, and one of the alliances he made is that he formed an alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and by the way he did it is he married his daughter. I mean, at verse 1 it says, And Solomon formed a marriage alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he took Pharaoh's daughter and brought her to the city of David until he had finished building his own house in the house of the Lord and the wall around Jerusalem. Now, you know, Solomon was a wise man even before God gave him wisdom, because even David commented on this a couple of times as far as Solomon's wisdom. But, you know, right here, almost in the beginning of his kingship, in the beginning of his reign, you know, I think he makes a mistake, because he ends up marrying Pharaoh's daughter. And the reason why he married it, because, like I said, he wanted to make an alliance, made a covenant there. And I can only assume that Pharaoh's daughter was not a convert. And the reason I say that is because a number of his wives that he married did not convert to Judaism. They continued to worship their own false gods. So this was the beginning of his downfall. You know, he began to plant the seeds right there at the very beginning of his reign, of his kingship. God specifically told his people in Deuteronomy chapter 7, in chapter 7 it says, Furthermore, you shall not intermarry with them, or with basically the heathen people that are around them, and you shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor shall you take their daughters for your sons, for they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will quickly destroy you. So what I kind of gather is this. Solomon did this out of expedience, feeling that, well, okay, if I marry Pharaoh's daughter, then I'm going to have peace with Pharaoh, and I'm going to, you know, have an alliance with him, and we'll have trade among each other, and it'll be really, really good for the country. But, you know, it was only the beginning, I think, of his downfall. Well, of course, the downfall took a great deal of time to really manifest itself, but this was the beginning. I think this is where the seeds were planted. And I'm going to talk about this a little more when we get further down as far as the number of wives that he had and how they began to turn his heart. But then it says here in that verse 2, it says the people were still sacrificing on the high places because there was no house built for the name of the Lord until those days. The high place was referred to as a place, it could be on top of a mountain, it could be on top of a hill. This is where usually the heathens would offer their sacrifices to their gods, and they would have their pagan rites, and usually it would involve a great deal of immorality and stuff like that.
Yeah. When you use the term heathen, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean the
non-believers,
heathen, pagans, in other words, the people that were worshiping, were idol worshippers or worshiping false gods, the people that were the nations that were within the borders of Israel, that were worshiping any other god than the one true God. I mean, that's what I mean by a heathen, because of the practices they got into. Like I said, they would very often have their idolatrous sacrifices and ceremonies on mountaintops or high places, and because they felt like this would elevate them to the point where they would be closer to their gods, or bring them closer to the gods in the heavens or whatever. But you know, God had specifically spoke too in Deuteronomy. He talked about these high places in Deuteronomy chapter 12. This is what God said. These are the statutes and the judgments which you shall carefully observe in the land which the Lord, the God of your fathers, had given you to possess as long as you live on the earth. It says, you shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations whom you shall dispossess serve their gods, on the high mountains and on the hills and under every green tree. You shall tear down their altars and smash their sacred pillars and burn their ashram with fire, and you shall cut down their engraven images of their gods, and you shall obliterate their name from that place, and you shall not act like this towards the Lord your God, but you shall seek the Lord at the place which the Lord your God shall choose from all of your tribes, to establish his name there for his dwelling. And there you shall come, and there you shall bring your burnt offerings and your sacrifices and your tithes and your contributions of your hand and your votive offerings and your freewill offerings and the firstborn of your herd and of your flocks. There you will also, you know, and then he says bring your household and stuff like this. But in other words, what God was saying is this: I'm going to choose a particular place where you are to worship. And I don't want you worshiping any place you feel like it, because this is what the heathens did. And even though people might feel like, well, we're worshiping to the one true God, the one God of heaven, God knew that if they got into the practice of doing that, that eventually it would begin to be polluted with the practices of the heathens. I mean, God just knew that. And, you know, even today, I mean, people may claim to be worshiping the one true God, but what are we told? And I think it's in Corinthians, where Paul talks about, hey, man, if another comes along, he starts preaching a different Jesus and a different gospel with a different spirit, you bear this beautifully. In other words, people could be misled, even if they claim that they believe in Jesus Christ. It may not be this Christ of the Bible. So God knew that this is what would happen eventually if people began to worship on these different places or high places. So that's why he forbade them to do that. But people did it anyway, and God tolerated it, but knowing full well that it would lead to idolatry. It would lead to an amalgamation of all kinds of different practices and beliefs and this type of thing. And sure enough, it did for a lot of people. But anyway, you know, God specifically told them that he was going to choose a specific place, you know, for them to worship. But remember what happened then when Jesus ran into the woman of Samaria? And basically the woman said to him, hey, who's right? He says, the Jews worship down there in Jerusalem, and we Samaritans worship here on this Mount Gerizim. Who says, who's right? And Jesus basically said the Jews are right, because they're worshiping in the place where they're supposed to worship. He says, but there's coming a day when God is going to seek those who worship him in spirit and truth. It's not going to matter where the place is. It's what's really going to matter is worshiping God in truth. In other words, you know, he's got to be the one true God, obviously, and we've got to worship him in his way, and we've got to worship him in spirit. This is what God is looking for. You know, it's not the place, it's not the building, it's not the church, it's not the denomination, it's worshiping in spirit and truth. Now, I don't want to get off on a tangent there, but people have often read this and said, well, what's a high place? What's a high place? Well, a high place is where basically the heathens used to offer sacrifices, but also at the same token, before God even instituted the Mosaic Law, we know that Abraham offered sacrifices and Isaac offered sacrifice and the patriarchs offered sacrifices to God, and they would offer him up on high places. All right, so this is something that was just basically carried over, and people felt like it was okay to do. And even Solomon himself did this, because look at that verse 3. Now Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father David, except he sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. You know, see, even he fell into this practice. But God allowed it, God tolerated it, because one thing I think when God showed some leniency here is because we're told that the temple wasn't built yet. So, you know, there wasn't that central place. However, there actually was, because the tabernacle was still erected, right? But I guess for various reasons, maybe it didn't accommodate the kind of sacrifices that somebody like Solomon would have, because obviously he had a great deal to sacrifice, and it probably didn't have the room at the temple at the time, or not the temple, the tabernacle at the time. But then it says here in that verse 4, it says, and the king went to Gibeah to sacrifice there. Now Gibeah, if you look on a map, it's only about 6 miles north of Jerusalem. So he goes there to sacrifice to the Lord. And it was at Gibeah that the Lord appeared to him. And he appeared to him in a dream, and the Lord asked him, he said, what is it that you would want? Ask anything you want, and I'll give it to you. And then Solomon, basically, he asked something that was very, very pleasing to God, because he said, man, you know what, I'm just a child. You know, I don't know how to go in or come out. In other words, I don't even know the simplest things when it comes to judging and ruling your people. He says, I pray that you give me wisdom, that I might be able to judge your people correctly. And God was so pleased with that. He just said that because he didn't ask for riches, ask for a long life, ask for the victory over your enemies, he says, I'm going to give you wisdom, and I'm going to give you all these other things thrown in. But the wisdom that God was going to give him, I think is pretty darn significant. Because look what he says here. Verse 12 says, behold, I have done according to your words. Behold, I have given you a wise and discerning heart, so that there has been no one like you before, nor shall one like you arise after you. That says a lot to me, because when I read that, I mean, I couldn't help but feel like, man, you know, I'm going to sit at this guy's feet and listen to what he has to say. And I've read Solomon's work over and over and over and over again. And you know, you can see the depths of his wisdom. I'd just like to share with you something from this book of the Antiquities of the Jews by Josephus. Josephus was a first century historian, a Jewish historian. And he just mentions this in one of his writings as far as Solomon, what he asked the Lord. Solomon said, give me, O Lord, a sound mind and a good understanding, whereby I may speak and judge the people according to truth and righteousness. With these petitions, God was well pleased and promised to give him all those things which he had not mentioned in his option, riches and glory and victory over his enemies, and in the first place an understanding and wisdom, this in such a degree as no other mortal man, neither kings nor ordinary persons, ever had. He also promised to preserve the kingdom to his posterity for a very long time, if he continued righteously and obedient to him. According to Josephus, there was never anybody ever lived before Solomon or after Solomon as far as being able to match his wisdom. I mean, that says an awful lot to me. I mean, the guy had tremendous insight, tremendous discernment, and he could see through things. He could see through the heart of a matter. And when you stop and reflect upon what God had said to him as far as giving him this kind of wisdom, it says so much to me as far as this guy's downfall. Because here he is, the wisest guy that ever lived, and he came to ruin at the end of his life. But he didn't start out that way. What I want you to keep in the back of your mind when we're going through this First Kings, especially, I mean, going through the writings of Solomon, or the life of Solomon, look at that verse 3. It says, now Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father, David. Now, it says a lot about the guy. When he was young, he had a real devotion for God, a real heart for God, a real passion for God, a real desire to seek God with all of his heart and serve God with all of his heart, mind, soul, and strength. But, you know, as we read further on, he's going to come to total ruin because of his love for women. And, you know, I don't want to get off on a tangent, but I just wanted to share what Josephus said about that, too. I'll just read a couple things that Josephus had to say about that, because it adds a little bit more light to what happened to Solomon. Josephus wrote, says, but although Solomon was become the most glorious of kings and the best beloved by God and exceeded in wisdom and riches those that had been rulers of the Hebrews before him, yet did not he preserve in this happy state till he died. Nay, he forsook the observation of the laws of his father and came to an end no way suitable for our foregoing history of him. He grew mad in his love for women and laid no restraint on himself in his lust, nor was he satisfied with the women of his country alone, but he married many wives out of the foreign nations, the Sidonians and the Tyrians and the Amorites and the Edomites, and he transgressed the laws of Moses, which forbade the Jews to marry any but those that were of his own people. And then it goes on and on, and he says that he basically just came to ruin because of marrying all these different women. I mean, he became basically ruled by his passions, ruled by his lust, until he forsook God. But that was his downfall. And I think that when we read that first verse about Pharaoh's daughter, he probably figured that this was a good, expedient thing to do politically, but it only was the beginning of his end. Because what happened was when he started marrying all these foreign women, they did not convert to Judaism. They turned his heart to worship their gods. And that's exactly what ended up happening to him. And I stand dumbfounded, wondering, how did such a wise man come to such a ruin in his life when he had such tremendous wisdom? And I think it's just basically a dark warning to all of us, because God did say in Deuteronomy chapter 7, he talked about not marrying the heathen women. And I know that I've read in editorials in the New York Times, and I've heard other people say things that affect it. The Bible was a racist book because God forbids interracial marriage. Well, that's just a bunch of poppycock. The Bible doesn't forbid interracial marriages, right? By any means. What the Bible does forbid, it says, being unequally yoked with unbelievers. That's what it does forbid. You know, it doesn't matter what race you are, as long as you're yoked equally as far as your faith and commitment to God is concerned. Anyway, before we go any further, or before we conclude the rest of this chapter, anybody have anyone to add or share to that? Okay, basically we're told that Solomon was given this wisdom, this tremendous insight, this tremendous wisdom. And now we're just going to read about, I think, a very classic example that a lot of people have heard about to demonstrate his wisdom. Because beginning in, pick up with that verse 15. Then Solomon awoke, and behold, it was a dream. And he came to Jerusalem and stood before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and offered burnt offerings and made peace offerings and made a feast for all of his servants. Then two women who were harlots came to the king and stood before him. And one woman said, "Oh, my lord, this woman and I lived in the same house, and I gave birth to a child while she was in the house. And it happened on the third day after I gave birth that this woman also gave birth to a child, and we were together. There was no stranger with us in the house, only the two of us in the house. And this woman's son died in the night because she laid on it. So she arose in the middle of the night and took my son from beside me while your maidservant slept, and laid him in her bosom, and laid her dead son in my bosom. And when I arose in the morning to nurse my son, behold, he was dead. But when I looked at him carefully in the morning, behold, he was not my son whom I had born." Then the other woman said, "No, for the living one is my son, and the dead one is your son." But the first woman said, "No, for the dead one is your son, and the living one is my son." Thus they spoke before the king. Then the king said, "The one says, 'This is my son who is living, and your son is the dead one.' And the other says, 'No, for your son is the dead one, and my son is the living one.' And the king said, 'Get me a sword.' So they brought a sword before the king. And the king said, 'Divide the living child in two, and give half to one and half to the other.' Then the woman whose child was the living one spoke to the king, for she was deeply stirred over her son, and said, 'O my lord, give her the living child, and by no means kill him.' But the other said, 'He shall be neither mine nor yours. Divide him.' Then the king answered and said, 'Give the first woman the living child. By no means kill him. She is the mother.' And when all Israel heard of the judgment which the king had handed down, they feared the king, for they saw that the wisdom of God was in him to administer justice." Now, like I said, this is a very familiar story, I think, to a lot of people. It's a very classic story. But I wanted to read just something, a brief account of what Josephus said, because he adds another dimension to it that I never realized before. And maybe it's no big deal, but I think it paints a clearer picture of what happened. Because Josephus wrote, he says, "When no one could devise what judgment could be given, the whole court were blind in their understanding and could not tell how to find out this riddle." In other words, to find out who the real mother was. "The king alone invented the following way to discover it. He bade them bring in both the dead child and the living child, and set one of his guards, and commanded him to fetch a sword and draw it and cut both the children in two pieces, that each of the women might have half of the living and half of the dead child. Hereupon the people privately laughed at the king as no more than a youth." In other words, people thought that was ridiculous. But look at the insight that we're given here as far as Josephus is concerned. Now, this isn't divinely inspired, but I think it gives us an historical account that I think broadens our understanding. They brought in both the dead child and the living child. I don't know if you ever crossed your mind. I just assumed it was the living child just brought before the king. But one of them brought the dead child. The other one brought the living child. And he said, cut them both in half. And, we'll give half to each one of them. All right, they'll split it right down the middle. Well, the people started laughing. They just thought, well, this guy, he's a buffoon. People were thinking this is Solomon. This is what Josephus says. Hereupon all the people privately laughed at the king as no more than a youth. But in the meantime, she that was the real mother of the living child cried out that he should not do so, but delivered that child to the other woman as her own, for she would be satisfied with the life of the child and with the sight of it, although it were esteemed the other's child. But the other woman was ready to see the child divided, and was desirous, moreover, that the first woman should be tormented. When the king understood that both their words proceeded from the truth of their passions, he adjudged the child to her that cried out to save it, that she was the real mother of it. And he condemned the other woman as a wicked woman who had not only killed her own child, but was endeavoring to see her friend's child destroyed also. Now the multitude looked on this determination as a great sign and demonstration for God about his wisdom. But I just share that with you because I get a little bit more, I think, of an insight of what took place there. You know, that people were basically under their breath. They were laughing and mocking at Solomon as being just a buffoon because of his youth. But then when they saw how he really handled the situation, they began to see that the wisdom of God in this man. And I think this is why this particular episode was given. It's just an example of his wisdom, because I think it really says a lot about the guy. I mean, if there was one person I'd like to go back in the Old Testament and just sit at their feet, it would have been him because of his tremendous insight. And I'll give you a little more of an understanding of that when we get into chapter 4. Anybody having want to add to that or anything you want to share? Okay, this chapter 4 says, now King Solomon was king over all of Israel, and these were his officials. Azariah the son of Zadok was the priest, and Elhoreph and Ahijah, the sons of Shisha, were the secretaries, and Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was the recorder. And Benaniah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the army, and Zadok and Abathar were the priests. You know, he mentions Abathar here, and remember that Abathar eventually was exiled and banished from the kingdom because he basically was a traitor. He threw in his lot with Adonijah in an attempt to grasp the throne from Solomon. Well, Solomon had him banished, and basically it was a fulfillment of what God had predicted, what would happen to the household of Eli. But he's listed here as one of the priests. And in verse 5 it says, and as Ariah, the son of Nathan, was over the deputies, and Zeba, the son of Nathan, a priest, was the king's friend. And just in passing, it talks about this Zeba. He's the son of Nathan, a priest, but he also refers to him as a king's friend. And remember, who else was King's friend when it came to David? Remember? That made a specific note about being David's friend. Anybody remember? It was his counselor, Hushai. It made a note that he was a friend of the king's. And here, this Zabad is the son of Nathan. He's a priest, but he's also a king's friend. You know, I don't want to make a big issue out of it, but I do think it says a lot. Because remember what Jesus talked about when he talked about in the Gospel of John. You know, he says that you are my friends. I call you my friends, and you are my friends if you follow me, if you obey me. That's basically what he was saying. And a lot of people may claim to be Christ's friend, but the acid test is obedience. And what is friendship? I mean, friendship, when you have a friend, I mean, there's a bond there. There's a unity there that is formed and cemented in trust. And you can entrust yourself to this person. That says a lot. I mean, if you really have a friend that you can confide in, you can really entrust yourself to them. In other words, you can reveal things about yourself to this other person, and you have confidence in this person that they're not going to expose you to other people with the intent of, destroying your reputation. You would be an utter fool to open up to somebody who you didn't trust, that's for sure. But anyway, like I said, in John 15:12, Jesus talks about what it is to be a friend when it comes to commitment to him. Anyway, in this verse 6 it says, Ahizar was over the household, and Adonai Ram, the son of Abda, was over the men subject to forced labor. And in verse 7 it says, and Solomon had 12 deputies over all of Israel who provided for the king and his household. Each man had to provide for a month in the year. And these are their names, Ben-Hur in the hill country of Ephraim, and Bedekur in Machaz, and Shaal-Albim, and Beth-Shemesh, and Elon-Beth-Hana, Ben-Hised in Arubboth, Sokoth was his, and all the land of Hefer, and Ben Abinadab, and all the height of Dor. Tapheth, the daughter of the Solomon, was his wife, and Bana, the son of Ahilud, in Tanach and Megiddo, and all Beth-Shean, which is beside Zarthan, below Jezreel, from Beth-Shean to Abel-Meholah, as far as the other side of Jokmeam, Ben-Geber and Ramoth-Gilead, the towns of Jair, and the sons of Manasseh, which are in the Gilead, were his. The region of Argob, which is in Bashan, 60 great cities with walls and bronze bars, were his. And Abimadad, the son of Edo and Hanaim, and Ahimaaz in Naphtali, he also married Basemath, the daughter of Solomon. Bana, the son of Hushai, and Asher, and Beeloth, and Jehoshaphat, the son of Paruah, in Issachar, Shimei, the son of Elah, in Benjamin, and Gibor, the son of Uri, in the land of Gilead, in the country of Shion, king of the Amorites, and of Og, king of Bashan, and he was the only deputy who was in the land. Okay, before we go any further, you know, he just mentions here 12 different guys who had a responsibility, a job, that was designated to them by Solomon to basically care for his household. In other words, I get this impression. You had 12 different guys, and what their job was that they were to collect all of the, basically the taxes, and the taxes were in form of cattle and wheat and barley and grain and fruits and vegetables and all of these things, flocks and herds, this type of thing. It was their responsibility to go forth, and they were basically tax collectors, I guess. They were in charge of gathering up all of these provisions for Solomon's household. And I think he divided them up into 12 groups, and each one had the responsibility to meet the household of the king for a whole month in a year. Now, I get this impression that probably what happened was that each one would set out, and over a course of a whole year, or basically 11 months, they would gather together all the provisions. And then when their turn came along, they would bring all these provisions to Solomon to provide for his household. Just in passing, I mean, we are all given responsibilities and duties and obligations here on earth. We're given talents, we're given abilities, and there's going to be an accounting someday. And remember what Jesus said in the Gospel of Luke. He talked about, I think, a very interesting thing when in Luke 19. He talked about these various cities and these various talents that people were given. Anyway, in Luke 19, verse 12, he says, "And he said, therefore," Jesus said, "a certain nobleman went to a distant country to receive a kingdom for himself and then return. And he called 10 of his slaves and gave them 10 minas." Now, minas basically is equal to about 100 days' wage. Okay, he said, "They gave him 10 minas and said to them, 'Do business with this until I come back.' But his citizens hated him and sent a delegation after him, saying, 'We do not want this man to reign over us.' And it came about that when he returned after receiving the kingdom, he ordered that these slaves, whom he had given the money, be called to him in order that they might know the business that they had done. And the first appeared, saying, 'Master, your mina has made 10 minas more.' And he said to him, 'Well done, good slave, because you have been faithful in a very little thing, be in authority over 10 cities.' And a second came, saying, 'Your mina, master, has made 5 minas.' And he said to him also, 'And you are to be over 5 cities.' And another came to him, saying, 'Master, your mina, which I kept, put away in a handkerchief, for I was afraid of you, because you are an exacting man, and you take up what you did not lay down, and you reap what you did not sow.' And he said to him, 'By your own words, I will judge you, you worthless slave. Did you not know that I am an exacting man, taking up where I did not lay down and reaping what I did not sow? Then why did you not put the money in the bank? And having come, I would have collected it with interest.' And he said to the bystander, 'Take the mina away from him and give it to the one who has 10 minas.' And they said to him, 'Master, he has 10 minas already. And I tell you that everyone who has shall more be given, and from the one who does not have, even what he does have shall be taken away. But these enemies of mine who did not want me to reign over them, bring them here and slay them in my presence.'" Now, this was a parable that was given by Jesus in the Gospel of Luke. It says a lot, because here we're reading about the delegation of these different men, that they had responsibilities, that they were given charge over certain territories to bring in the tribute, or basically the taxes, to provide for Solomon's household. And I just really feel like this: when it comes time for judgment day, even Christians are going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ. We are told that in Corinthians, and we're told that in Romans, that even as Christians we will stand before him and give an accounting for what he has given to us in our life, and how we have basically utilize the talents, the resources, the time, the money, the energy, the effort, or whatever else he's given us in our life, how we've utilized it for his glory, for his honor, for the salvation of souls, for the edification of his church. And there's going to be accounting there. I think that a lot of Christians, this has just gone way over their head in terms of this responsibility that we have before God. But here's the thing. If we utilize what God has given us in this life for his glory and for his honor, we do the best we can with what he's given us, what's going to happen to us? He's going to turn around and give us a great deal more responsibility in the next life. That's what that parable meant in that Luke 19. And that the people that have done nothing with their talents, if they end up being saved at all, they'll have basically no responsibility when it comes to the authority that's given to them in the next life. That's what Jesus is referring to here. So when he's talking about these men here, like I said, you read it, it may appear like, well, on the surface, it certainly seems like a lot of useless information that's basically boring and bland and has no relevance to us thousands of years later. But then there's always a spiritual application you can draw from it, because we're told that all scripture is given to us for our reproof, for our example, for our edification, for our understanding, this type of thing. And I think that says a lot when these men were listed here as men that were given this kind of responsibility before Solomon. Anyway, anybody have anything want to add or share before we move on? Okay, because it says in that verse 20, it says, Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand that is on the seashore in abundance. They were eating and drinking and rejoicing. Now Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the river of the land of the Philistines to the border of Egypt, and they brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. Now, you know, just say in passing here, this is at their zenith as far as Israel's history is concerned. It was under basically David and Solomon. It says he ruled over all the kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines. I can't see it on that map here, but whenever it talks about the river, it's talking about the Euphrates River. This is what God had basically promised Abraham, that he would his people would possess the land all the way over to the Euphrates River down to, apparently, the River Nile in Egypt. So even though the people of Israel don't possess that land in its entirety, even during the time of Solomon, Solomon is a type of Christ, and it's saying here that he ruled over that territory, even though his people didn't possess that entire territory at this particular time. Never in their history have they possessed what God had promised them through Abraham, but they will during Christ's reign. They will possess that much land. Their borders will extend from the Mediterranean Sea, from Egypt all the way to the Euphrates River. And, you know, what we're seeing here, this is a kind of like a prelude. It's almost kind of like a glimpse of what it's going to be like when Christ is ruling and reigning, when he sets up his millennial kingdom. Because Solomon is a type of Christ too. And you see during his reign, anybody remember what Solomon means?
Peace.
It means peaceful, you know. And when Christ comes back and sets up his millennial kingdom, he's really going to be known as the Prince of Peace. And we're told in Joel, and we're told in Isaiah, that they shall beat their spears into pruning hooks and beat their swords into plowshares. That's going to happen when Christ is ruling and reigning. There's not going to be any wars. There's not going to be any insurrections or any revolts throughout the world. There's not going to be any suicide bombers running around. There's not going to be any terrorists. There's not going to be any of this type of theft going on when Christ is ruling and reigning. There's going to be total and complete peace and economic justice, and people are going to be living in tranquility. Well, this is what you see under Solomon. Okay, in the beginning of verse 22, it says, and Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cores of fine flour and 60 cores of meal, a core is something like 10 bushels, I think. I mean, it's quite a bit. And he's talking about the provisions that he has just for his household. It says in verse 23, 20 pastured fed oxen, 100 sheep, besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and the fattened fowl. For he had dominion over everything west of the river from Tipsha even to Gaza, over all of the kings west of the river, and he had peace on all sides around about him. So Judah and Israel lived in safety, every man under his vine and his fig tree, from Dan to Beersheba, and all the days of Solomon. And Solomon had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen. Just in passing, I know some manuscripts say that it has 4,000 stalls of horses. I know if you look up in 2 Chronicles 9:25, it talks about 4,000 stalls of horses. And I just say this in passing. This very well could be a copyist error. But if it's not a copyist error, in other words, if you look at Chronicles where it says 4,000, what that could mean, you know, and this is totally speculative on my part, is that remember that Saul had a standing army of about 3,000 men, and so did David. That was basically his bodyguard. Well, if both of these accounts are right, and this is not a copious error, what that simply means is that Solomon had probably 4,000 horses right there in Jerusalem that were used for his bodyguard, for his basically, you know, his standing army that he had in Jerusalem. But overall, throughout all of Israel, he had like 40,000 horses. But you know what? Here's another thing where he made, I think, a big mistake. Because when he started multiplying his horses, if you remember what Moses wrote in the book of Deuteronomy in chapter 17, Moses basically said, or basically God was talking to his people when he says, when you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, and you possess it and live in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations who are around me, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses, one from among your countrymen who shall set as king over yourselves, and you may not put a foreigner over yourselves who is not your countryman. Moreover, he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never again return that way. And neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart be turned away, nor shall he greatly increase his silver and gold for himself. Now it shall come about, when he sits on the throne in his kingdom, he shall write for himself a copy of this law on the scroll in the presence of the Levitical priest, and it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by carefully observing all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted up above his countrymen, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right or to the left, in order that he and his sons may continue long in the kingdom in the midst of Israel. Now, the reason I read that, it was from Deuteronomy chapter 17. You know, God gave specific instructions here. Don't multiply horses, don't multiply wives. What was the reason why God didn't want kings to multiply horses?
Because the horses are strong and can accomplish much on behalf of man's desires. And God says that he takes no pleasure in the strength of horses.
Well, yeah, because you know what? Horses equal power. Horses and chariots, this type of thing. And God just knew that if they were to put together this massive army and these horses and these chariots, this type of thing, you know, they would put their trust, their confidence in their armies, in their navies, in their horses, in their power, rather than God. And sure enough, that's what would happen. And then he talked about, you know, don't multiply wives for yourselves, because they're going to turn your heart from God. It's basically what he said. But what's interesting, and the reason I read that much in Deuteronomy, was that God gave very specific instructions to the king. Who remembers what his responsibility was? He had an obligation. What was he supposed to do?
Read the word.
Yeah. He says, now it shall come about when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself a copy of this law on the scroll in the presence of a Levitical priest. In other words, he had the obligation before God to write out this entire law, the entire five books of Moses, basically. And he had to do it right there in the presence of a priest or a scribe, you know, making sure that he crossed every T and dotted every I, that he didn't skip any words, that he didn't make any mistakes. And then when he wrote a copy out for himself, he said here, and it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by carefully observing all the words written in these laws, and et cetera, et cetera. Well, I get the impression, now maybe I'm wrong here, but I get the impression that Solomon failed to do that. Because it, to me, if he had done exactly that, he may not have made some of the mistakes that he did. Even though in all of his wisdom, either he just flat out ignored God's word, or he wasn't aware of what God had said here. And multiplying horses and multiplying wives, you know, it kind of went to his head, and rather than seeing his dependency upon God. But that's why I kind of really emphasize how it said early when he was a young man, how he really loved the Lord and followed him. Well, little incremental steps at a time, his heart began to turn from God. And, you know, if you begin to look at it, to me, it's amazing. It's amazing what happened to this guy, because you would think with all of his wisdom, he would have been able to see through the pitfalls. But it's amazing what can blind a man. And Solomon was blinded by his lust. And look at Satan. What we're told, and I think it's in Ezekiel and Isaiah, when it talks about the fall of Satan, he says that he was perfect in wisdom and perfect in beauty. And you got to ask yourself, man, how does this angel, who is known as the star of the morning, son of the dawn, Lucifer means son of the morning or son of the dawn, okay? You would wonder, if he was perfect in wisdom, how is it that he fell? The perfect logical sense would have dictated that, hey, if God created me, then he's got to be far greater than me. Now, you know, I'm getting way off on a tangent here, but, you know, I've often reflected upon this and thought about it, meditated upon it, and wondered about it. How is it this angelic being, with all of his intellectual powers and his wisdom, how is it that he could have thought for 1 minute that he could be like God?
That would be pride.
Yeah, but he had to have some kind of, to me, he would have to have had some kind of explanation as to how he could be like God. Maybe I'm not asking this right, but you know what I think it was? And this is totally speculative on my part, all right? Totally. But you know what? I believe that Satan was the first evolutionist. And I believe that evolution has been spawned by him from the very inception when he put it into man's head. But I think this is what happened to Satan. I think he got somewhere along the line in his existence, even though he's perfect in wisdom, he had to probably think to himself, you know what? I must be going to be able to evolve to the point where I'll be like God. So I'm going to ascend my throne above the stars of God, and I'm going to be like the Most High. Like I said, I'm getting way off on a tangent here. I'm probably all over the turf. But have you ever wondered how a creature that was perfect in wisdom could make such an incredibly fatal mistake? Well, I believe that that's how, you know, he reasoned within his heart, that God must be evolving and I must be evolving too. You know, I think that's probably what it was. And that's what I think gave him the, what do you want to call it, the guts of the stupidity to instigate the revolt that he did. Anyway.
The Bible does say that he was perfect in wisdom, but I think it's more of a relative thing. I mean, obviously he wasn't perfect in wisdom. Only God is perfect in wisdom.
Well, it says that about him. He was perfect in wisdom, all right, and perfect in beauty. That was imparted to him by God. There was probably nothing hidden from him as far as his wisdom is concerned, and yet I do believe that because of, you know, probably God's revealing his desire to create man and have angels minister unto man, that probably kicked off a revolt in his heart, and he probably felt like, well, you know, I'm evolving. I could be like God. Anyway, like I said, I've been all over the turf here, but I just wanted to...
There had to be some kind of blinding.
Yeah. I believe the pride blinded him, but what got him to that point? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And what could bring him to the next step? Anyway, you know what? I've been all over here, the turf here, and I don't even know... What verse... Okay, I left off in that verse 26. We're talking about the horses here, and then basically how it led to don't multiply wives, don't multiply horses. And then verse 27... And those deputies provided for King Solomon, and all who came to King Solomon's table, each in his month, they left nothing lacking. And you know what? It lists all of these different things just for one day's provision for his household. I mean, it's quite amazing, isn't it? You look at some of this stuff. It says, verse 22, it says, Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cores of fine flour and 60 cores of meal. Like I said, I think a core is something like, it's 10 bushels or something like that. Anyway, he said he had 10 fat oxen, 20 pastured fed oxen, 100 sheep, besides deer, gazelle, roebucks, and fowl. I mean, you look at what he has here as far as one day's provision. That's mind-boggling, isn't it? It just shows you how massive his court is, his entourage is. He provided for, I'm sure, as far as his bodyguards or whatever else. So it was, the people were they were pretty well being taxed, weren't they, in order to support this massive bureaucracy. So nothing's really changed. Thousands of years have come and gone. But I think what's kind of significant, too, is that it just shows that, you know, if Solomon is a type of Christ, how God is going to provide for his people, for his household. And then verse 27, it says, and those deputies provided for King Solomon and all who came to King Solomon's table, each in his month, and they left nothing lacking. Verse 28, they also brought barley and straw for the horses and swifts, steeds to the place where it should be, each according to his charge. Now God gave Solomon wisdom, very great discernment, and breadth of mind, like the sand that is on the seashore. And Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the sons of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt. For he was wiser than all men, than Ethan the Ezrahite, and Heman, Kol, and Darda, the sons of Mahol. And his fame was known in all the surrounding nations. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. And he spoke of trees from the cedar that is in Lebanon, even to the hyssop that grows on the wall. And he spoke also of animals and birds and creeping things and fish. And men came from all the peoples to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. Now, you know, just in concluding tonight, you know, it says a lot about Solomon when you just read about what's being said about him here. His wisdom, it says that it was very great as far as discernment and his breadth of mind. He could, you know, talk about things anywhere from insects or, you know, what do you call it, entomology or beasts, or zoology or birds. You know, anything. I don't care whether it's fish. He'd look at something and he'd be able to give you insight to these different things and how it pointed to the honor and glory of God. It says a lot about him. And what also says a lot about him is he wrote 3,000 Proverbs. Well, you go over to the book of Proverbs and we just have a few hundred of what he had written, because actually the Proverbs that Solomon had written, if I'm not mistaken, they really don't start till about around chapter 10. And he's not the one that wrote all the Proverbs that are in the book of Proverbs. Okay, there's a couple other people that wrote some Proverbs that are there. And I tell you what, if there's one book that I would like to find, as far as antiquities goes, I would like to find all the rest of his Proverbs. Because we only have a fraction of what he had written here. It says he wrote 3,000 Proverbs. And it says here that he wrote 1,005 songs. How many songs do we have of his today?
A couple in the Psalms.
And he wrote the Song of Solomon. That, to me, is the greatest song that's ever been written, because we went through the book of the Song of Songs, or the Song of Solomon. That is really, really a profound book. You look at the depths of it, I can see why it was the Song of Songs. But what happened to all the other songs? You know, he wrote 3,000 Proverbs. We don't know what happened to most of them. But if there was any book I would like to be able to find or read in antiquity, it would be all the rest of his Proverbs, because you know, I've read his words, his Proverbs, over and over and over again. There's such tremendous insight. Here's the thing too, it's, you almost wish, boy, if you can have somebody like Solomon today and pit him against some of these academic eggheads who are forever trying to minimize God's role in creation. They are forever trying to negate there even being a God, that we all just evolved. I mean, I almost wish you could have the mind of Solomon or the wisdom of Solomon to confront these people, because so many people are just so intimidated by these evolutionists, by these people who refuse to give God the honor, the glory, or anything else when it comes to his creation. But look at Solomon. I mean, he could look at anything. I don't care whether it was an ant or whether it was a galaxy, and he could comment on it and open your mind as to the creative genius of God. And his incredible design, and how these things just couldn't have possibly just simply happened by happenstance or happened by chance. Anyway, it also basically says here that there was nobody like him as far as wisdom, and they mentioned several of these guys who were basically, I guess, they were known for their wisdom. Well, they couldn't hold a candle to Solomon as far as his insights, his understanding, his discernment, his judgments, everything that this man could perceive and see through. And like I said, Solomon is a type of Christ. And when you stand in the presence of Christ, I think it's just a foregone conclusion. I think we're just going to be blown away in terms of his wisdom, his knowledge, his insight, his understanding, his genius. Anybody have anyone to add or share?